You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thor,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is...
Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am super excited to have Vanessa Lilly on the show with me today. She has an amazing new book. It's called For the Best. And I'll tell you what, if this is not on your bedside table or, wherever you do your reading, you are missing out. This is a must have for this fall. Welcome to the show, Vanessa.
Thanks, Hank. I'm such a big fan of the show. It's an honor to be here. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. Vanessa, you've listened to some shows, so you know that we begin each show with the same question. And that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
So this is embarrassing. I was actually thinking this morning about the reality of being on the show, because I know this question's coming. And I was like, wait, you know the answer, and it's embarrassing. But here we go, right? So my earliest memory of wanting to be a writer was in second grade. We had an awesome library teacher at my elementary school, Mrs. Sawyer. And she had heard about, this is in northeastern Oklahoma, where I'm from. She had heard about a contest where you kind of make a book and you submit it to a larger contest. And we actually got, I don't know if you know this, but like if you ever want to wallpaper a room, they'll send you a big wallpaper swatch book. I don't know if you've seen that.
Yeah.
So we made our book covers out of wallpaper swatches, and then we put the pages, we glued them in to kind of like make our own. It's like the earliest indie press, basically. And I had this idea, because I was obsessed with fairy tales, to do like a princess and like knights and, dragons, fairies, but I'm not good at drawing. And this was supposed to be a picture book. And so I put it off until the night before. And I have this very vivid memory of sitting down the night before it's due and just completely selling out and writing a book about friendship. And it actually, my teacher loved it because it was a sweet book. I knew that she would want to read about people being good friends to each other. I mean, I just had these very conscious kind of creepy thoughts about what Miss Sawyer would like. So I was writing to market, and
that's so funny, by the way.
And I, procrastinated until the last minute and then didn't get to do what I wanted to do. So there's definitely some lessons for me in there.
So how old were you then?
It was second grade.
Second grade. So you're like six or seven, probably about seven, or eight.
So pretty little. Mm-hmm.
Wow. That's a lot of regret to carry around,
The thing is, I still got picked. So I got, I was selected for, I think I won a book or something because of it. But I, had this, this sort of constant, as a writer, you learn, there's no perfect.
Right.
Done is better than great.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And that was a very early formative lesson for me. And also, don't procrastinate. I've never learned that lesson, but.
Well, what sticks out to me, Vanessa, is that you use language like I sold out and I wrote to market. Do you still have feelings like that? Like, this is something that writers legitimately wrestle with.
Yes.
How do I write the thing that I feel like I'm supposed to write? And I've got big air quotes, around supposed to write, because, writing kind of feels like a calling sometimes. And we use this language like that. It's a higher calling almost, that writers are important people. And I say important in air quotes, like this is something that has the potential to affect a lot of people. But on the other hand, we know the realities of publishing. We know the realities of what's going to connect with a larger group of people, because it's definitely better to connect on some level with actual people than to have this thing that you're passionate about and it not connect with anyone because it's all about you. You know, how do you juggle those two feelings?
It's a lifelong tension, because I think I just am now putting out my second book, so I'm still very new to the business, but it is a business, and that's not a criticism. That's just a reality. Right. And there is this constant tension, at least in my experience and talking to friends who are authors, between kind of writing what's in your heart and the implication being the thing that's in your heart might not sell. And so you have to find, I guess, a middle road sometimes and do your best to create something, you know, that you do care about and you are interested in. But, you know, the market matters, and there's salespeople and marketing people and everyone kind of reading this and looking to sell a product. And if you go too far one way, you miss out. Though I'm sure there are some people who do write their heart and it just maybe works out every time, but I haven't met a lot of those people. I think most of us struggle with, you know, with just finding a balance and especially people, you know, for thriller writers, I think often there's this expectation of a book a year or a book every, you know, year and a half or two. You know, you're writing fairly quickly and the market is changing all the time. So it's not that you're writing to market, but you're definitely seeing what's selling and knowing how you sold before. And, you know, all of that just kind of swirls in your mind.
So you're a thriller writer. You obviously write mysteries with great tension. And have you always been a fan of the genre? And do you remember what the first book was or series or author that kind of opened your mind to what this genre can do for readers?
Mm-hmm, yeah, definitely Christopher Pike. I read every book of his in the Miami, Oklahoma middle school library, cover to cover, endlessly. I had a friend whose mom bought her all of the books too. And so we were also constantly trading them and talking about them. And his books were so, to me as a middle schooler, exciting, because the plots were kind of, you felt like you were maybe hanging out with cool older kids. There was sex in them, which, you know, that's riveting. You know, there's some cussing and they're really dramatic and over the top and kind of like delicious. And I loved him. I loved those books. And, you know, they spoke to me. I also read a lot of Anne Rice and she's obviously a very different writer than Christopher Pike. But what I loved about Anne Rice is that, I mean, her novels are so long and so complicated. And you can just wrap yourselves in them. Like it's consuming as an experience for a reader. And, you know, just the darkness and like the vampire series or her Mayfair Witch series. I loved it. And I always enjoyed stories that had, you know, a real edge.
I got to interview Anne Rice about a year into the show. And I'll tell you what, it was such a mind-blowing experience, because I'm such a fan. Mm-hmm. And to just sit there and like, she's a real person. Like, she took time to come on my podcast. Like, mm-hmm. You know, you don't think of these luminaries. They're just people, you know, but yeah. it's such
who happened to create some of your favorite books and moments.
Oh, yeah. Like, just, sure. Yeah. Never mind that.
Right. Like, you know, I feel like Lestat is out there in the world somewhere. I mean, they're just the most vivid characters who are with you forever.
Exactly. So you talked about growing up in Oklahoma, in a little town called Miami. Is that right?
Oh my God. That was a perfect pronunciation.
Thank you. I've practiced that.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm.
You no longer live in Oklahoma, is that right?
No, my parents, who I was just talking to on the phone this morning, are right there in Miami still. And my brother and his family are in the Oklahoma City area. So I'm back there, well, under normal conditions, you know, once or twice a year at least.
Gotcha. But you no longer live there. Are you in Rhode Island?
No, I live in Providence, Rhode Island. So I was in Washington, D.C. for about 10 years for grad school and just work. And then my husband and I moved to Providence for his job. And we're completely obsessed with Rhode Island and New England in general. But Rhode Island is such a cool, quirky, interesting place and really supportive of creative people and writers. So I feel very lucky that this is where we ended up.
I love that. I also love to hear how a sense of place affects people, you know, going through their life. And a lot of times our formative years are spent in a place, but then you can move away from that and maybe spend more time away than you were ever there. But it's always this kind of weird piece of you. Do you feel like where you're from affects you as a writer, as an artist? And do you feel that tug of kind of the American heartland, even though you live in New England? And does that ever come up with you at all?
Yeah, I think Oklahoma is, I guess, technically Midwest, but I just think culturally there's just a lot of Southern ties. And and I would say particularly just around storytelling. And I grew up, my dad is a storyteller. And really, my mom, I was just thinking that this morning, my mom was telling me some funny story about my family, and she was making me laugh. And I just thought, this is how we communicate. We are constantly telling stories, trying to get each other to laugh, trying to entertain each other. There's just this tradition of telling stories. And it's also how something I appreciate from my parents particularly was that they were always very honest with me. I mean, my dad, for example, had a really rough childhood and an alcoholic father and abusive and all kinds of things. And it was never hidden from me. He told me crazy stories. And I just really appreciate that, because you learn that there's kind of like power in truth and in honesty. And you don't look away when things are difficult, and you talk about it. And I think with the thriller genre, and in terms of just how I write, you know, I try not to look away. I try to really dig in and push myself to explore the really hard questions and, you know, tell the stories, because that's just how I was raised. And you are just honest about, you know, the good stuff and the bad stuff and all of it. And I think in the subjects I've explored, they're kind of difficult. My first book was about kind of very severe postpartum depression, and this book deals with female white privilege, and those aren't really easy topics, and they're things that I would maybe rather ignore at times, but you know, you gotta tell the story.
Speaking of that first book, it came out last year, Little Voices. Because you were published with Thomas and Mercer, who is a subsidiary of Amazon, or at least an Amazon-owned publishing house, let's say it that way, fully independent from Amazon, self-publishing or whatever, but they're owned by Amazon.
Yeah.
But because of that, a lot of times they'll take upcoming books and they will release them to Amazon Prime members, and you get to read books early. And I remember this book from last year. And I remember thinking, oh, this is phenomenal. And for whatever reason, we didn't get to connect last year when that book came out. And, you know, but regardless, I loved that book. Tell me the story of that book. So you said that you spent some time in Washington, D.C., then settled in Providence, Rhode Island. At what point did this writer desire come knocking again, and you know, ultimately the book Little Voices, you know, is what came out of that. Mm-hmm. But what was it that got you interested in writing again, and you know, ultimately culminated in this book?
Yeah, so this is probably kind of a familiar story for you. I was just listening to Sean Cosby's interview with you actually.
I love Sean. Week.
And he was talking about how he, you know, wrote a lot as a kid, and then he stopped for a while, and then he came back to it, and that's what I did. I wrote a lot as a kid, left it alone for a while. And in my 20s, I felt that longing to be creative again. And, you know, I really believe in the kind of Stephen Pressfield resistance theory that if we ignore creativity, then we're going to be really unhappy. And I think that unhappiness was really, even though a lot of things in my life were good, was just festering. And so I was honest with myself, and I figured out that I really missed the creative side. And so I started writing, and I wrote two books over 10 years, which is not a good ratio, but you know, you got to get your 10,000 hours in. And I made a lot of friends while doing it. I actually joined Romance Writers of America in the beginning, because it was, my first book was like a women's fiction, which is an awesome place to cut your teeth. Those ladies. I mean, I know there's been a lot of falling out recently, but back in the early 2000s, I mean, they take craft so seriously because a lot of people don't take them seriously.
Yeah.
And they really provided almost instant access to me, like MFA level information. And they pushed characterization. I mean, a romance novel, the reason you pick it up is to see two characters change enough to be together. And right. That's really hard to do. I mean, it's incredibly challenging. And I think even though I write thrillers, a lot of that is still, that structure is still in my mind, because character growth and character changing, that's what we read for. I mean, yeah, it's the twists and turns, but it's all in relation to the character. So, you know, even though I didn't write romances and my women's fiction will always be under my bed, that was very impactful to me. And then when I finally sat down and decided I should probably write what I read, I decided the thriller I worked on for about 5 years, I actually queried extensively. I got like probably about 150 rejections from agents, a lot of them really nice and helpful. And I was kind of just hearing a lot of this, send me your next thing, which is not easy to hear at the time, but in hindsight, I know what they meant, which is, you know, the voice was getting there, but it just wasn't there. And so we moved to Providence. I have my son, and I decided, like, for the first time in my life to just not work, which I feel like I've always had two jobs. And like, that's kind of a loss of identity that I hadn't factored into my psyche. But anyway, I became a full-time mom, and he didn't sleep much. And so I would have to take walks with him, and I would wear him when he was a newborn, you know, with the soft wrap, and he was just like against my body. And I would just walk up and down the neighborhood
papoose
street.
Kind of thing. Yeah.
Papoose. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
But not on the back, on the front. Yeah. And would walk up and down the streets of Providence. And, you know, pretty soon my writer brain started to wake up again. And I began to imagine a new mother as well, but she was trying to solve her friend's murder. But I wanted her to really be struggling postpartum, because I think I was struggling postpartum. And I also just had a lot of really big new mom feelings, you know, that I wanted to explore, because your heart is suddenly outside of your body and your life is completely changed. I mean, just in ways you could never have imagined. So it was great, because I could actually put all of those feelings and emotions into a book. And I decided not to take 5 or 10 years on this book. I actually did National Novel Writing Month. And so I wrote it in, I typed the end and meant it after about 2 months, and revised it over a year. And then when I went out to query, because I kind of been through this before, I pretty quickly found my agent, and she pretty quickly found Thomas and Mercer, which is great. And they've been wonderful. And so it kind of just came from, you know, 10 years of work, and then finally kind of writing a story that was very close to my heart and my experiences, which, if you're someone who's trying to get your debut published or you're considering it, I do really recommend kind of, I don't like the phrase, write what you know. I mean, it's a fine phrase, but I think what that is saying is you can skip ahead a lot if you're writing about something that you're just very firsthand knowledgeable about, you know,
right.
That in the early days of writing, you know, and certainly like even now, like on my third book, you know, I can feel myself getting better, but to actually sit down and just completely create a new world is incredibly difficult. But if you're kind of writing from an emotional true place, maybe even writing about somewhere that you've lived or you live, I think it can skip you ahead a lot of steps. That you'll be able to make up later as you produce more books. But for your first one, I mean, selling a debut is really hard. And, you know, it can kind of be a little bit of a couple moves forward that maybe you wouldn't have otherwise.
Noveler is the best way to write a novel. Why? Quite simply because we've made it the easiest place to do it. Writing a novel is hard enough. Noveler takes care of all the logistical bits of writing a novel, just leaving that small matter of the words to you. It's a clean, beautiful writing interface with writing analytics, goals and streaks, advanced grammar checking,
version control, day, evening, and night modes, and many other features designed to take all the stress out of writing. Tell us what you need and we'll build it. Together, we'll build a better tool. With a design-led approach, all the right tools that you need, Noveler saves all your words constantly, allows you to manage and order your novel easily. It's accessible from any device, desktop or mobile. It syncs to Google Drive and Dropbox. It allows exports in various formats, including ebook and more. It also has nice touches like allowing you to write both offline and online, unique for a web-based platform. Everyone needs help with their writing from inspiration through to grammar checking, so we're doing our best to provide that support. We integrate that support directly into Noveler. Our advanced grammar checker powered by Pro Writing Aid does everything from spell check to style advice. Our writing courses include the incredible Tim Clare's Couch to ADK. We're really excited to offer all Author Stories listeners 30% off Noveler for a whole year. And it doesn't matter if you choose to sign up for the monthly or annual plan, you'll get 30% off. All you need to do is use the discount code Hank when you sign up. Noveler, N-O-V-L-R. That's noveler.org.
So much about what you said there just fired off all sorts of questions in my brain. But you alluded to writing what you love to read. And while that seems like such a duh, you know, statement, mm-hmm. To me, that is a mistake that a lot of new writers make. That for some reason, we feel like we should be writing in this genre or that genre. And it may not be what we as readers just truly love. You talked about writing romance, but what you really loved was thrillers. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that we wrestle with that? And what are some of these expectations that writers get that, like, why would Vanessa Lilly think that she had to write romance novels when what she really loved was thrillers? And I'm not just picking on you because this has happened to me.
Absolutely.
You know, like, why do we do that?
I think there's... I think often the people we admire, like I had a strong admiration actually for Nora Roberts, and I still do. Sure. And who wouldn't want to be Nora Roberts? But,
right.
You know, I think you, especially when it's early days of writing, you have these pictures of Stephen King or Earl Stein or whoever, Anne Rice. And you, on some level, try to think, all right, how am I going to get there? Which is not fair because every single writer's path is different. But it's you just do it. And then you also maybe think about critics, and you think about what your family will say, and you think about what your partner will say. And so you think, oh, you know, I'm not going to write horror. Maybe I'll try to, you know, I sometimes read Jonathan Franz and maybe I'll try literary fiction because you imagine that is maybe more worthwhile or something. I think we stop ourselves before we've even started a lot of times because of fear, because of what we imagine people will say, what we imagine people think we should be doing. I mean, you know, it's all ridiculous to say now, but in the moment and when you're sort of grappling with putting your words on a page, especially for those early first times, it's so hard and it's so scary. And so those criticisms and those fears are really loud in the early days. And then, you know, it maybe gets a little easier later, not that they go anywhere, but you know, when you're first starting out, I mean, there's a lot of fear because everything is unknown and it's scary.
Absolutely. You talked about taking NaNoWriMo, National Novel Writers Writing Month, to work on this manuscript, and it took about 2 months. You said that's a very fast pace for writing.
It was a terrible
novel
first draft
for a lot of people. Well, and I think that's the confusion that a lot of people have, that they think of NaNoWriMo as, and this was probably true in the early Kindle Revolution days, people would bang out a novel with NaNoWriMo or whatever, and then just immediately publish it, you know, on Kindle. And some of those people, you know, went on to have very prominent careers. Some people flamed out, and you know, there were a lot of people that got into publishing, things didn't pan out, and then you saw a lot of those people leave. But then you said after writing this fast first draft manuscript, then you took a year to revise it.
Right.
Could you talk a little bit about the writing process and why it's more than just that first draft? Like what goes into, you know, just because you typed the end on that first draft, it's nowhere near the mm-hmm. end of the process for you.
No, as a matter of fact, I just typed the end this morning on my third book.
I've gotten to where I just go and just type the end from the beginning, and then everything's easier from that way.
Right, you feel good. You're like, it's all right away. So NaNoWriMo was really valuable to me because, like I said, it took me 10 years to write two books. And some people, that's okay, but for me, it was not. And I just knew I needed to write more efficiently and faster. And I'd always been a pantser, which is a person who writes by the seat of their pants, and lots of successful authors are. But for me, it really just meant I was spending time with my characters in a room talking to each other and not doing anything. So I learned structure, and particularly Save the Cat Writes a Novel by Jessica Brody is a fantastic book. Yeah. Donald Moss also has some good books about structure. There's a ton of great craft books out there. And I learned craft. So when I sat down for Nano, for the first time in my life, outlined. And it's not people really, if you aren't an outliner, you probably are like, ugh, outliners. But for me, it was more, I just needed a little roadmap, and lots of things change along the way. But at least if I had my arms around the story, I could kind of stay focused, because when you're writing in such a short amount of time, you really are all about the words. And there's a power to that I think I've noticed, you know, after going through Nano and now publishing two books. I hear this from a lot of authors where they're like, oh, I got to get my 1,000 words in today. And it's not that they're saying to be successful, you have to write 1,000 words. What they're saying is it takes that drumbeat of just grinding out 1,000 words a day to get to where you're at 80 or 90. And it isn't a magical long weekend where you write something brilliant, and it's really a grind. And maybe it's different for some people, but most people that I've talked to, it's just doing that daily hard work. So Nano, you do that kind of times 10 because you're writing a lot of words a day. But at the end of it, it's the same result. You've got a rough draft, and it's not great, but you at least have something to work with. And truly, I believe for my process, all the magic is in revision. I mean, it's where you have a sense of the story and you've actually spent time with your characters and you can see better what's working and what's not working. And, you know, that the work of editing to me is what can take a lot of time. And it's really where a novel can go from okay to really good or good to great is in you being able to just pull the threads together and deepen the emotion and deepen the characters. And you feel like, ugh, this chapter is boring. Well, then you can fix it. Or why is this character doing this? You know, like you're a reader, so you have gut reactions to things, even sure. if it's your own work. And so, you know, I spent that year both revising on my own, working with some critique partners for Little Voices, actually, and for The Best, for both of these books. For Little Voices, I hired a developmental editor. And she, you know, worked with me on the craft of the book and really leveled me up, which working with a great editor, in my experience, does. And for The Best, Thomas and Mercer had a developmental editor that I worked with, too, as part of their process. And then for my third book, I hired another one. So I really believe in working with other people in collaboration to try to make something better. And so for anyone who does Nano or is working on a draft, if you find that you're dragging your feet on your book or you find you're just not getting anywhere, I do recommend a fast draft, even if it's not Nano. Give yourself 3 months, but really stick to a deadline and grind it out. And then know that after that process, you know, you'll still have a lot of work to do, but I feel better having that draft done. Like yesterday, yeah. I was really in a cranky mood, and it was because it was at the end of this draft and I just wanted to be done. And, you know, there is a certain lightness that comes from at least you have the draft done.
Well, it's a whole lot easier to edit a crappy first draft Absolutely. Than a blank page.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. No comparison. Absolutely. Yeah.
I forget who said that first. But that's absolutely true. So you wrote two books over 10 years And then little voices came together really quickly. And then, of course, the revising that came after that. But some people will say that you had a great idea for little voices. And that's, you know, you had a golden idea. And that's what made the book come together. Other people will say, well, you can take any idea. And if you just have the right attitude about it, you can turn any idea into a golden idea. Do you feel like Little Voices was, do you feel like the premise was special, or was there a mindset change that happened with you?
That's such a really interesting question. I would say, we were talking about Marketplace earlier, for a debut, if it's a thriller debut, you do need a really good hook. I mean, I wish it wasn't so, but it really is so. Like, it's got to be the same as something, but very different. And it's got to, for an editor to set up and buy something, it does really have to have some kind of an edge that they think people will like based on it being kind of like other things that have worked well, but also, you know, your own kind of stamp and brand. So that I think is true, but with Little Voices, I think what that was at the end, there's this like pretty big twist. And that wasn't there at the beginning of this process. That came to me as I was writing and I realized something about my character and realized what had happened and that this was a reality and I needed to weave that into every single page. But I didn't know that at the beginning. In fact, when I realized what that twist was, I was very sad and kind of depressed about it because it was a sad twist. And, you know, I also fought it for a long time. That's something I've noticed. Like, I also fought some things in For the Best, and I also kind of fought some things in this third book I just wrote. And I find that when I'm fighting something, it's usually because it's right. It's just scary and hard. And the scary and hard things are usually what make the book the book. So I do think that that can come if you're, you know, if you're being honest with yourself about what's working and what's not working. And as I was writing Little Voices, I was like, there's just something here that's not right. Like, the feelings I have are not just fitting in a straight thriller about a woman trying to uncover her friend's murder. That's just not enough. And so I had to kind of open my mind and really think hard about what I was trying to say and what the feelings I was trying to communicate, what within the plot could kind of communicate them. So they're not easy questions, but I do think even if you just have a character, you can still find all those other elements if you're willing to really just push yourself and follow it.
So Little Voices, you know, a year later has over 2,000 ratings on Amazon, better than 4-star reviews, 4.2, I think the last time I checked. For a debut novel, very positively received from people, and a lot of people read this book. So, you know, and you talk about the process that got you to Little Voices. Well, now that Little Voices is done and it's out in the world and people are receiving it and reading it, then Vanessa, the writer, has to follow that up. You know, we talk a lot about the gift of anonymity that happens for debut authors. Nobody knows that you're writing this book. Sometimes, you know, sometimes it's a select few family members. Sometimes not even that, mm-hmm. but nobody expects anything from you because you haven't done it before. Well, now that you've got a book out that has connected with people and people generally like the book, then what's next for Vanessa Lilly? You know, these kinds of feelings come about. Well, now For the Best is out, and, you know, congratulations on the publishing of that. And there's links to it in the show notes of this episode, of course. How do you follow up, you know, a success like that? And what are those feelings that you dealt with in the beginning of For the Best?
That's a good question, Hank. So For the Best was a really tough experience for me. I was really overwhelmed by being a debut, which is not a unique experience in the least. And, you know, I did have, you know, a lot of people reading it, and I'm so grateful for that. And my publisher, Thomas and Mercer, they have that, as you said, the Amazon First Reads program, which basically gets your book out a month early to, I don't know, nobody knows how many, but a lot of people. And so I was super grateful for that program, but it was kind of like being shoved into the pool to see if you can swim, which I'm not complaining about, but it was kind of crazy. And leading up to that, you know, I wrote for The Best before Little Voices had come out.
Sure.
But, you know, there were just things happening that I, and I knew I had to write this book under a deadline, under a contract for the first time, which is just, you suddenly, as you were saying about no one knows about it, not only do people know about it, but people who you feel so much gratitude toward, like your publisher, your agent, these people who you don't want to disappoint, and you and the readers you imagine you'll have, you don't want to disappoint them. And so you sort of, for me, I was writing this book with this fear that it would inevitably people say, oh, is this not as good as her first one? And fear is a hard place to write from, especially when it's, you know, coming from, you know, I just didn't have a lot of experience. So
yeah.
I wrote for The Best, and it was 120,000 words, which is about 30 to 40,000 words too many. my main character, Jules, who is still the main character, was so, she made Amy from Gone Girl look like a charmer. I mean, it was, she was such a mess. And my editor, God bless her, Jessica Triple, read it. And she was like, I love the voice. You know, she likes my writing, like all of that. She's like, but you are really good at revising. You need to completely rewrite this book. So I did. And, you know, this is just because you've written one doesn't mean you can write another. So when I was debuting, actually, I completely rewrote for The Best. I stripped out an entire point of view. I cut, I don't know, 50,000 words. I added vlog chapters, which I love now. That was my editor's suggestion. So it's my main character is trying to prove herself innocent of murder. So she starts a true crime vlog. So the video, you know, vlog, kind of a video blog where she goes around searching for clues and tapes it. And so I created transcripts for each of those things that happen. So it was a lot. And, you know, I was also debuting at the same time. I'm not complaining. I was grateful the entire time that anybody wanted this book.
Yeah.
But I think it isn't easy. And I've heard from a lot of authors, and I kind of knew it was coming, that your sophomore book is really tough. And mine was. But I think you're just so grateful to even be playing the game,
yeah,
for me anyway, that I just, you know, I just did it. And it was that, you know, I had to get like 2 chapters a day revised. You know, I had like a schedule. And that's what I did. And I was behind constantly, but everyone was kind. And I ended up getting it into a place that I was so proud of. But it was a complete gut job renovation.
Tell me about Jules. Where did she come from for you? And kind of how did she start revealing herself and the things that she's going through to you?
Mm-hmm. Jules. So her voice came very strongly into my head. It is not my voice, but it was this character voice. And I wouldn't say that's true for Little Voices. This experience with Jules was different. And she is someone who has lived a pretty privileged life, and she is accused of murder. And so she leans on those privileges to try to uncover who killed the person she's accused of murdering. And she began, I mean, the most kind of immediate moment I can think of is I saw this photo of Angela Peoples, who's a brilliant activist, at the Women's March in Washington. And the photo is everywhere. It's Angela Peoples is holding a sign. There are three, Angela Peoples is a Black woman. Behind her are 3 white women in the pink hats taking selfies in front of the Capitol building. And Angela has a sign that says, "Don't forget, white women voted for Trump." And for me, I knew that when I sat down to write another thriller with a white woman at the heart of it, I had to think about what that means within the genre and to me, because, you know, in Little Voices, she was barging into the police station and she was hunting for clues in the neighbor's bushes or, you know, whatever it is. That's normal.
Yeah.
And it's fine. And it's not a criticism of how people write. But for me, I knew that I couldn't just write another book with a white woman at the center of it and not take into context these choices that seem so contrary to our self-interest. and what it is that makes someone have such a point of privilege that they can't even see the harm they're doing, or that they would risk their family, that they would, you know, have a, my main character, Jules, has a really bad alcohol problem, which she gets from her father, and just generational privilege, generational alcoholism, and just how, you know, we get so wrapped up in the structures that have been built to keep us in place that, you know, we don't know our heads from our tails. So Jules and her voice, you know, came to me, and it was really me just not, I'm not pointing a finger at white women. I'm pointing a finger at myself and my own times when I have been a call the manager, Becky, my own times when I've, or Karen, when I've, you know, not been sympathetic to a friend of color, who, or just, you know, I assumed everything would work out for the best. I mean, that's where the title comes from. It's this implication of privilege, this idea, of course, everything works out for the best. You're a white woman in a country that was built to protect white people. Yes, of course, things do work out for the best. And just what those assumptions are. And, you know, with all that said, it is a thriller. I mean, you know, that's like, it's got to be entertaining. But I do not believe, I'm actually working on an essay for Crime Reads right now about this topic. And I've been talking to some authors about it, which is, I just don't believe that you can ignore politics and you can ignore the context in which we live in thrillers, because it is justice and it is crime and it is families. And so, you know, for me, I just went full on in, and I knew a lot of people wouldn't, hopefully not a lot, but some people, you know, won't like it. And I honestly, writing it, felt uncomfortable a lot, because I felt like Jules in her form holds a mirror up to a lot of things that I don't like to think about with myself. And so this book was very much me pushing myself to be honest about how I've acted in the past, how I see the world, how I expect the world to be. And, you know, she was pretty wild, so it was fun to follow her around.
Well, isn't that the great thing about fiction, especially, is that we can see news reports of things going on, and we can say, well, you know, this news organization is biased this way or that way, and we can build these walls up between us and the story that helps us to filter those things in a certain way and not feel as connected to them. We all do it in one way or another, but there's something about fiction, because we get to get inside the head of a character. And we start to feel empathy for a character who's not real, by the way, but we connect with them. And then you can lead us through a story like this. And, you know, we might see the world a little differently. We might even change our mind about something, you know, God forbid, or, you know, we connect with people through fiction in a way that can't be done in any other medium. That's fascinating to me.
Well, and it's empathy, and that if empathy. Anything is going to save us, it's empathy and putting yourself in someone else's shoes. And, you know, if someone tells you they don't read, I would be scared of them, because to me, reading shows that you can listen and learn from other people. And even if it's hard, there's work to be done. And I think crime fiction is the perfect place to do that work.
I agree with you. What's interesting to me, is that you said that you wrote this book more than a year ago. The events of 2020 had not happened when this book was written, even revised. And then to see the world that we're living in now, this book just seems that much more poignant. Were you surprised to see how 2020 has unraveled and what this means for your book?
In a devastating way, yes. Yeah. I think I'm a little bit relieved that we're having more conversations about it. Sure. And honestly, I don't think I even have the language for what I was feeling back when I was looking at that photo of Angela Peoples, and I was feeling guilty. And, you know, there'd be moments where I would think, when I was writing this, and I would think, you know, maybe I'm just being a little bit harsh to white women. And then the next day there would be a news story about a woman calling, you know, the police, you know, on a kid grilling out at a lake because he was black or whatever. And I just think, you know what? Nope. Let's just keep going down this road, because there's just something hear in the air that's bothering me. And I don't like, you know, how I'm seeing other white women act. And I wanna look at it. And also how I'm acting. I mean, I'm not perfect, and I've made tons of mistakes. And I think that's the most important part of, you know, trying to be anti-racist or trying to be progressive, is knowing that you are making mistakes every day and being okay with it and trying to learn and grow. And so I am deeply grateful for all the people who are helping white women like me learn, which is a gift to give, you know, and better allies, advocates and supporters. And there's a language now around privilege. There are a lot of, you know, this idea of what white feminism has done to women of color that was just starting to get at least talked about on a level where I had heard it. You know, it probably was academically talked about, or certainly I'm sure women of color knew all about it. But from a white woman's perspective, I didn't really understand what modern white feminism had done to many women of color. And so as the conversations kept progressing and there was, you know, just more essays and more books, and I started to be like, okay, I'm not just, you know, picking on white women. I'm really exploring our assumptions, exploring what our privileges. And even though it is sad and frustrating that this is a topic of conversation, it was also a relief that I wasn't just completely off base, which could have happened, but it was something that people were also recognizing and talking about.
Well, and Vanessa, before people just dismiss for the best out of hand because of the statement that it makes, this is a fun read. This is a thriller of the best kind. How do you balance having something to say, having something that you personally, as you said, you know, have wrestled with, and you're wrestling with these topics on the page? How do you balance that with, you know, this is a fun read. This is, mm-hmm. this is why we love thrillers, because mm-hmm. we love seeing people in jeopardy. We love getting to connect with them and then seeing how they're going to resolve this and what is going to go on in the world and how are things going to be different. Yes. How do you balance those things?
Well, I'm a very impatient reader. This is probably not a good thing to admit, but I put books down very easily, and I'm not really proud of that, but it's true. And so as a writer, I am an impatient writer. I need action. I need twists, and I need my characters to just grab me by the throat as often as possible.
And I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
No, I don't either. You know, I mean, I think everybody likes what they like, but, and so for me, I write what I like, and I love a voicey, strong character just grabbing me by the shirt and just hauling me through their story as fast as possible. And the, you know, the political elements, the things I have feeling about being a white woman, all of that comes, you know, within me and within the story. But at the heart of it, it is a thriller. And I actually, to me, I obviously Little Voices is my debut. I love Little Voices. And it felt like a pretty heavy book. And some people told me, oh, I read it in one night. And I was like, wow, that's amazing. Because I felt like it was a book that, I don't know if it's a slow read, but there's just a lot going on. So when I sat down to revise for the best, I was like, my dream is for people to read this in like one or two sittings. Like, I want them to just whip through these chapters. They're short. There's long chapters. I mean, we are moving. So that's what I wanted to do. And even though there is a lot of, you know, topics I wanted to explore and issues to bring up, at the end of the day, I was like, the priority truly is making this as close to a page turner as I can write.
Well, the book is called For the Best, and there are links to it in the show notes of this episode. I'll tell you what, Vanessa, what I'm excited for is the audiobook, which when people are hearing this, the audiobook is actually out now. But because of the magic of podcasting, we're recording this before it actually releases. And I've read the arc, but I'm super excited for the audiobook. And I'm really intrigued at how this is going to interpret to audio the different vlog transcripts and things that are, I think it's going to be really dynamic. Have you gotten to listen to any of the audiobook yet?
I haven't. I have it, and I sent it to my friends over at Audio Shelf Me. They're two booktubers and Instagrammers, and they review audiobooks, and I had them listen to it, because this is so silly, but I don't have a CD player. And they loved it. And they have a very high bar. So I will have a CD player soon, and I can kind of have a moment to listen to it. But as I understand it, the narrator, I think Terry Chabal is her name, does a fantastic job. And I'm actually at the end of September going to have an event with her and Audio Shelf Me, and we're all going to talk audiobooks.
Well, I have an Audible credit that's just waiting for it to release on Audible.
Let me know. Yes,
I will, and I'll post it in the show notes of this episode as well. For the best, available everywhere now. When you're hearing this, Kindle edition, paperback, or Audible audiobook, go grab it today. Vanessa, this has been so much fun talking. Where can people find you online if they want to connect to all the great stuff that you do?
So certainly my website, which is my name, it's Vanessa, and then my last name is spelled like is the flower, but spelled weird. So it's Lillie. So VanessaLillie.com, and then I'm always on Instagram, which is just at VanessaLillie, and Facebook as well. And I have a newsletter too, and I love hearing from people. So email me and let me know what you're watching on Netflix.
Absolutely, we'll put links to all that in the show notes to make it easy for people to find you. Vanessa, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show.
This is so fun. I really appreciate this opportunity.
Authors, I have a fantastic new service to tell you about. It's called PubSite. PubSite is a service to help you build your very own website, your home on the web, where you can promote your work and give your fans a place to connect with you. PubSite is a website platform that allows every author, regardless of budget, to have a great-looking professional website. Developed by the book marketing professionals at FSB Associates, PubSite is the new easy-to-use DIY website builder developed specifically for books and authors. Whether you're an author of one book or 20, or a small publisher, PubSite allows you to build, design, and most importantly, update your website pain-free. No need to be dependent on a designer or webmaster to make a small but costly change to your website. Save the money and do it yourself. PubSite is the best platform for authors because it's a book-centric platform. PubSite was built just for authors and small publishers. Every design, feature, and layout is book-centric. They have customized designs for you to use. It's easy to build. No coding or HTML is necessary to create a stunning, professional-looking website with all the features you want. Get a custom domain name, yourname.com. It's simple to update. You can add all of your books, add a blog and a book tour, sell from any retailer, manage your email list and social media, and even do e-commerce. Build your website with a 14-day free trial, then pay just $19.99 per month, which includes hosting. And we offer packages starting at $499 to set up the website for you. Pub-site.com, the place to help authors find their home on the web.